Matt Preston, wonderful to have you here as our music teacher. Thanks for agreeing to do this.
I can't tell you how excited I am. I'm an absolute nerd when it comes to music, and when you sent me the kind of the homework that I had to do, I found it very hard to control myself.
Well, I was surprised at the number of Australian tracks on the list.
You know, I think growing up in London, there were certain bands that made a real impact on me. Less so the ones maybe that are better known here, like INXS, but bands like The Saints, that I'm Stranded single was a, you know, as punk was coming out in London when I was like a young teenager, that was one of the records we loved. And then later on, you know, the arrival of that first Church album and albums by the Go-Betweens, the Triffids. I mean, these bands became very hip and very underground and very valued during a certain period in London when there maybe wasn't so much cool stuff going on. And then it continues on with Nick Cave, obviously, and the Bad Seeds and, you know, the Dark Horses, Tex Perkins and all that stuff. So, and then there's also stuff that you discover. I've been here 25 years now. The stuff you discover here that people play you, like the Angels or like the Sunny Boys, and you go, why did that never reach outside of Australia? Because it's such a rippingly good song.
Who played you the Sunny Boys? Who introduced you to the Sunny Boys?
Any number of blokes that I play cards with. It's one of those songs that invariably comes on. There's lots of, obviously they've gone back on the live circuit, and so, you know, people keep telling you how great they are live. And it's less of a religious experience for me to go and see a band like that because I didn't grow up with them. But gee, what a cracking single. Picking out, still don't know. All I have is alcohol,
so let me go. How did you get into the punk scene in London? How did that happen?
I grew up in Chelsea, in Fulham. So I was like around the corner from Boy, the Malcolm McLaren store where it all started. So you go and see dodgy bands playing in basements of dodgy pubs, and it becomes a thing. You start listening to John Peel on BBC, on the, you know, the national broadcaster. Great job, similar to what Triple J does here, where you hear, you know, stuff that no one's heard before, and you're right, next thing you know, you're standing at the Roundhouse watching the Stranglers, or you're watching the Ramones at the Rainbow. Or
what an amazing time to be in London.
Oh, unbelievable time. The Clash, you know, the Clash at the Rainbow, that first album, London's Burning album, 70, but the shows were 78, but I mean, unbelievable. And because they're, you know, in that awful cliched way that maybe, you know, bands like Hilton Hoods are writing now about music that directly references the Australian world that their fans live in. The Clash, London, Burling was directly referenced. I grew up at the end of the Westway when they sang about the Westway, or they sung about the clubs, or they sung about things they were doing. That's the stuff that we were all doing. So I mean, it's fantastic to kind of be in the album. I'm up and down the Westway, in and out the light. What a great traffic system. It's so bright. I can't think of a better way to spend the night than speeding around.
Matt Preston is here tonight. If you hadn't guessed, he's a big fan of music, possibly more than food. Are you?
Yeah, quite. You know what I think it is? I think food is quite a singular pleasure. Maybe you enjoy it with three or four other people at a table, but that's the maximum you get. And the great thing about music is the aggregator. It's going to a big concert, whether it's 100 people in a basement or whether it's 40,000, 50,000 people in a field in Glastonbury, that when that song comes on and the whole place starts singing along, it's a truly transcendental moment. And food can never give you that. It can never give you that moment the music does, whether that comes from U2 or Alt J or, you know, whoever.
Let's get into this large list of songs that you've come in with
for
us. And thank you for doing the homework so thoroughly. Yeah. Where did you find this fellow?
Into my arms. Oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms.
Now, is that about that particular track or more about
Nick Pave? No, I think it's about Nick Pave singing Tupelo as much as it is about that track. I mean, I think he's an amazing performer, and that track's particularly fond one because if I had a song with a woman I love, it would be that song. And it's the words, the lyricism of that man is phenomenal. If I believed in the interventionist God, I mean, people often talk about popular music being quite shallow, that there's lyricism there that Verdi and Rossini would have been proud of.
And ask them to watch over you. Well, to each burn a candle for you, to make bright and clear your path, and to walk like Christ in grace and love and guide you into my arms. Into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord.
How about Augie March?
But for one crowded out, you were the only one in the room. I sailed around all those bumps in the night till you'll be gone in the gloom.
Wish you could see the look on Matt Preston's face. You've got goosebumps, I can tell.
No, I did it with both those songs because I think, and again, another band, in that case, I think originally out of Melbourne. But that song is absolutely beautiful. And I think one of the challenges for Australian bands has often been that the musicianship is unbelievable, but the lead singer isn't quite as good. And there are exceptions. I mean, obviously, Augie March is a great exception. Temper Trap is another great exception. I mean, that voice is phenomenal. But I just think there's a wonderful melancholy about both those songs that's quite beautiful and just does get you doing exactly that. Little goosebumps on the back of your hand.
Play music yourself?
I play terrible guitar. I've been in a number of bands. I had a weird experience the other day of someone I've not seen for 30 years posted a review of one of the bands I was in, which was very bizarre because it brought all that kind of rehearsal room history flooding back. I love it, but I'm terrible. I'm a classic three chord punk musician.
When did you start playing?
When I was in my first band when I was 15, 16.
So this was in London by the time?
That was in London. Yeah, all in London. I've been in a succession of bands, all equally bad, a couple that were okay, and I still play. I still, when I moved to Sydney to make MasterChef for the first 4 years, my wife gave me a really beautiful acoustic guitar, and that became my vice. That became my, instead of going out and raging through the bars of Sydney, I'd sit at home and noodle on my guitar on the balcony. And then I had this terrible experience of living in a place in Sydney. And one of my favourite things to play, along with Nick Cave and, Leonard Cohen, is obviously to play some Paul Kelly, of course, because it's the, they're simple songs and they're
He's
great.
The Poet Laureate of Australia.
Poet Laureate of Australia. You can sing along with him. It's great. And I would be there murdering Paul Kelly songs. And I think I've been there about 3 weeks and I walked downstairs and there was Paul Kelly. Sitting, he was in the foyer, and he lived like two flats down from me. So the poor Paul Kelly had been subjected to me massacring his music.
Which song in particular were you murdering? Because there's always one that.
To Her Door, undoubtedly.
Did he acknowledge that?
Well, I was so embarrassed, I just didn't. Oh, right. Like that, and walked on.
He pretended it was a neighbour. Well, it wasn't me.
I'm not admitting it.
And his heart was singing like a low down guitar.
Now, this is interesting because I know this band. Lloyd Cole and the Commotions came out to Australia and they booked the Entertainment Centre, which was a massive venue, huge venue back in the day in the 80s. And out came Lloyd Cole and the Commotions, and there were about, 3,000 people at this venue.
Whoa.
He walked out on stage and he looked around and he said, okay, wrong venue, but hey, let's just give this a whirl. It was one of the best concerts I have ever been to, but I'm curious about why you chose this particular song.
She crossed herself as she put on her things. She has promised once before not to live this way. If she don't calm down, she will burn herself out like a forest fire. Well, doesn't that make you smile?
See, most people would have gone Rattlesnakes or Perfect Skin, I think, if they were looking for a definitive Lloyd Cole song. Why Forest Fire?
I think it would be Ready to be Heartbroken. Personally.
Oh, yes, that's
true. And I did think about playing that because I was going, that's a song that absolutely typifies a big breakup in my life. And I felt, I can't play that because it's too, like, personal. And I was sitting around with a friend of mine recently, and we were just playing tracks to each other. And we went, what about local? And we played that complete range. I reckon any of that album is worthy. And people who love Lloyd Cole, they will listen to all. It's not an album you listen to three tracks of. You listen to the whole thing. It's fantastic. The lyricism, again, is brilliant. You know, it looks like Evelyn Marie sounds. I mean, what?
In On the Waterfront.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, exactly. I mean, that's fantastic.
She looks like Evelyn Marie in On the Waterfront. She reads Simone de Beauvoir in her American circumstance.
And I think also I had this weird thing with Helen Razor, who used to do Breakfast on Triple J, who was a mate of mine. She said, what are you doing? We're going out to have Japanese. Do you want to come? We're going to bring a mate. We're going to play cards. And the friend was Lloyd Cole. And we ended up playing poker with Lloyd Cole and eating sushi. And it was like one of those surreal moments. Because I'd seen Lloyd Cole's first London show. They'd come down, I think, from Scotland. And they played Ronnie Scott's. They did five songs. They did Perfect Skin. They did Rattlesnakes. They were un-freaking believable. They then toured with a band called the Blow Monkeys that a friend of mine was looking after. So I travelled with my mate, the A&R man, who looked after the Blow Monkeys. We saw Lloyd Cole maybe a dozen times, from the smallest venues all the way up to, you know, the Palais in Melbourne.
How did you end up friends with all the funky, groovy music people? How did that happen? Because you were writing as a journo, weren't you?
At university, I had mates who went to the art school and they ended up in music. And so through them,
you did politics and government, didn't you?
Yeah, but I worked in magazines. I worked in a dirty, filthy, communist, left wing workers cooperative. We all got paid the same, and we had a music department. And I promoted concerts, and all my friends were working in the music industry. And so our night out, and it was the dream trying to be in London. Our night out would be, all right, let's go to Ronnie Scott, see Lloyd Cole and the Commotions. Apparently, they're quite good. And my mates from a couple of food magazines, a couple of mates who work for the music press would be there, and we'd have a great table. Someone else would pick up the bar tab.
Even better.
And we'd love it. And, it, you know, being whatever it was, like 22 years old, that you're just living the dream. You have no money in your pocket, but you're living this kind of champagne lifestyle. It's fantastic.
Except for the heartbreak story, which you alluded to but skipped over. What happened?
That was actually later on. There are certain songs that you, as you know, that, you know, albums that whether it's Neil Young's After the Gold Rush or the Lloyd Cole, that, you know, music and ice cream are the two great salves for the soul when your heart's broken.
Mm.
And we know that, you know, it's one of the great inspirations for songwriting. So there are certain songs that I think you automatically associate with certain times. Just like the great stuff, you associate a song with the summer or a song with a trip. I always, second time I went to Glastonbury, we played the Knack's My Sharona all the way back from Glastonbury back to London for 3.5 hours, headbanging all the way.
Were you wearing cravats at this stage?
Occasionally. I mean, I like to call them scarves.
scarf.
Because it's normally always a random length of material rather than a wasted fancy cravat, because they're expensive. Whereas length of material you can get for like a dollar and it covers up the bare neck on a cold day.
When did the cravat thing happen? How old were you?
1607. I was a Croatian mercenary. It's the way we used to identify each other when we were fighting for foreign nations. It started then. It started. One of my best friends gave me this blue, white, red, and black kind of African printed strip of material. And I had a really nice, which I'd found in an op shop for £5, what's called shark skin, which is like a close woven silk that feels cold and like slightly slippery, like fish skin jacket. So I had this white shark skin jacket and I had this blue and white scarf and I wore those two together. And I found a black and white picture of myself wearing them, almost like proof that back when I was 19 years old, because I think when I came along, people assumed that I'd come out of central casting. I'd been styled by a kind of computer in a room full of people going, yes, he needs to be pompous, so we'll give him a cravat. Blazer, yes, blazer, good. So it was very much, you know, I think with all three of them, myself, George and Gary, what you saw was actually what you got. And on TV, as you know, sadly, people get trapped into playing roles and it's not very authentic. And after a while, either you become that role, which isn't what you want to do, or even worse, you get so upset playing the fake role that you end up, you know, leaving it.
So there you go. Wearing cravats. You weren't styled before you became...
And I have pictorial proof of it. Pictorial proof. I do like colour. I do like material. So, yeah.
So how did you end up writing about food instead of music?
Well, I wrote about music for a long time. When I moved to Australia, I came to write about Australian soap operas for the UK.
You were in your 30s.
I was 32. And so I wrote about Nathan Hanway for 5 years. And in that period, someone I'd met through, you know, talking to magazines and got her own magazine said, I know you cook. We'd become friends. And she said, do you want to write a restaurant column? And I went, well, I get paid to watch TV. That's a pretty lazy one. If I get paid to eat as well and I'm allowed to take my mates out and we eat out together, how fantastic will that be? So, you know, traditionally reviewers get money for two meals. So what we would do is we'd go out with four of us and we'd split the bill and we'd all pay like half the amount. And it was a great way of just living that same thing. Not a lot of money in your pocket, but you're living a much better lifestyle. And that's where it all started. And I was lucky enough to not get to be able to, you know, develop my own voice there, which sounds very pompous. But that basically meant not reviewing the way everyone else reviewed. And, you know, just making a review all about the people that are there, or making the review all about the one dish you had to eat, or starting the review with the desserts and working backwards rather than there's a real language of reviews in Australia where it starts with opening paragraph, why you should go there, what the room's like, who's in the room, entree, main, dessert, service, closing paragraph. And it's very predictable. And to be able to play with that form is quite exciting.
Matt Preston is here. He's your music teacher tonight. And we're going through the tracks that he loves. This one. To that song, because you're staring off into the distance.
Actually, I was thinking of a number of places. Common Room, University, 80 People, The Boy Tour, U2 Play. They weren't great. We didn't like them. We walked out of that way. They're all right. They're great. They're good, but they're not like amazing. And then you have that awful post Red Rocks moment with U2 when they did that live Red Rocks show, when you go, oh, we missed that. You know, we kind of underrated that. We underrated that moment. But I think I picked the song for one very good reason. Actually, it's the last time I saw that kind of era U2, which was a Band-Aid. You got tickets to Band-Aid. And obviously, Band-Aid's had a lot of conversation. Live Aid's had a lot of conversation because of the Queen performance, which was in which Rami Malek did the most unbelievable recreation of. But if you were there, That was a great performance, but the performance that stole the show was U2. And it was, and as everyone was, as the 85,000 people were all leaving the stadium, you could hear from every corner of the stadium that chorus ringing out as everyone sang that walking out.
I was intrigued that this next track's on your list. The Black Keys. I was a bit, I don't know, it just seemed most Matt Preston-like, but having now spoken to you for a while, I'm kind of now understanding why it might be there.
But you can see the link to the... I mean, we could have played a whole range of punk stuff. We could have played the adverts, Gary Gilmore's Eyes, which I've been introducing a lot of the friends who have introduced me to Australian music, playing them that song. We could play some Elastica. We could see that long line of punk music, the Lemonheads or whatever, all running down. But that two guys making that much noise, and that has become... Whenever I do live shows, that's the music I now walk out to because it automatically gives me this massive jolt of adrenaline. And you can hear that, just that little bite. You know, I think maybe some people get that from Thunderstruck or some of the AC/DC stuff, but for me, that song does it every time.
How about this one? Have a love. Oh, baby, you travel. See, that's another ripping track, the Sonics.
That is amazing. What, that is an amazing version. I don't know. I want that version because it's very hard to find a clean version of that song. The saxophone. There's an amazing band called Wailing Howie Casey and the Seniors, which has got a baritone sax that honks like that. I love the sax line. Sonics, Seattle, precursor of grunge. In that when we were talking earlier on about psychedelia and that new psychedelia wave, the Sonics, 13th Floor Elevators, the Seeds, MC5, they all, that really early form of garage psychedelia. And that how can you not want to dance to that record?
Yeah, it makes you move.
It's so simple. But again, you can, the link there between playing Lonely Boys and that is so close.
Yes.
You can totally understand it. Totally understand it.
When you first came to Australia and you went to live music gigs here, were they much different to the music gigs that you'd been seeing in Britain?
I think I was so impressed by the musicianship here was really good, really, really good. Like in England, it'll be about the lead singer and the band will be okay. Here, the bands were amazing, and then the lead singers were a bit more questionable. I think here the real difference here is that in England we didn't really have a Triple J. So you had to go and you found it through the music press and through talking to people and going to live gigs. Whereas I think when you come here through the street press and through Triple J, you very quickly get to know that you need to go and see this band or that band. And so when I first arrived here, I worked on a couple of music documentaries with a couple of friends of mine here. And that also took me out into seeing stuff and like those amazing, you know, early big day out concerts.
Matt Preston is here. He's your special music teacher tonight, and he's taking you through the tracks that he loves. We're about to get onto the ones he doesn't want to hear again.
Oh, no.
Tracks like this one.
Yeah, that's enough.
Dead.
Yeah.
that's an Australian treasure. That's Eagle Rock, Daddy Cool.
Yeah, but there's Australian treasures that are great, like the Sonny Boys, and there are ones that aren't like that. There's something about that. Although, having said that, I have a new appreciation because I've now got an 18-year-old son. And if anyone out there who's got an 18-year-old child will know that, strangely, that song has become very fashionable again.
So have some very old songs from my childhood that my son, who's also 18, is now listening to.
Now, the question is, when he hears that song, does he drop his Dax and dance around with his Dax around his ankles?
I've not been privy to that,
possibly. Well, I can tell you right now, you need to ask him the question because we had a whole mob of the boys round kind of, you know, end of the year, And the next that song comes on, and they're all dancing around in a big circle, doing a kind of like almost like a madness dance with their dacks around their ankles. And I've gone, okay, this has become another thing, and I've got to reassess Daddy Cool.
I'm gonna turn around, once, and we'll do the eagle run.
Because you've got three kids. Do you introduce them all to music?
Well, I think now they're introducing me to music, which is fantastic. I think it started that first way. And now the weird thing is now that I'm playing their playlists, then ELO will pop up. And that's kind of like, wow, okay, that's interesting.
Hello. How are you? Have you been all right? Through all those lonely
I'm discovering lots of stuff from them. And actually, my middle son has now put a ban on my wife's car playing anything other than Triple J. Because everything else is daggy. Look, our music has to be on at all times. And I love that thing of that, you know, when we all love something, when we don't love something, when we argue about something. But the whole point is you've got these three little scouts now going out and bringing back new songs and playing you a Fisher track or playing you a Hermitude or something like that. And you go, okay. And then you get those lovely, my son went out to a club because he heard that like a well-known Australian kind of underground band was playing a 3 o'clock set, a.m. set. And they did turn up. They did an hour and a half and he was there and only 100 people. And I went, oh, that's weird. Apple tree, not falling far. I love the fact that they love music. It would be weird if they just went, oh, I don't like music. You know, my daughter walks around the house singing. That's when you know when she's happy. It's a brilliant thing to link people together. The same way food does, I think.
What did your parents think of you liking music? Were they musical?
No, not at all. I remember my mother telling me that she really liked my Pink Floyd albums. So like, I'd be playing them and she'd hear them when she was in the bath. My dad was into playing Tom Lehrer, who's a kind of American comedy. Again, great lyrics, very funny, slightly satirical, but also slightly wrong. And then there was also kind of HMS Pinafore and a lot of Gilbert and Sullivan, which is, you know, less my speed. But yeah, there was always stuff. There was always stuff going on. Then he went through a period of loving Charlie Pride, who is a country singer. And I just thought that was a weird left turn to him, and I didn't really get it. Maybe he had an American girlfriend. In fact, I think he did. I think that might be the reason. There's normally, if someone starts listening, Chris, if someone starts listening to a totally different type of music, be suspicious, be very suspicious.
It's actually very good advice.
Mm.
Okay, which brings me to this. It's probably an interesting musical choice, actually, to have right now.
Gonna find my baby, gonna hold her tight, gonna grab some afternoon delight.
Now, this is on the list of tracks you prefer not to hear again.
Queen of the segue. That is a genius segue. You're absolutely right. Everything is wrong with that song. The cheesy vocal, the lack of morality, that awful guitar sound. And it's kind of that jauntiness, which is not really the sort of jauntiness you expect to hear about a song about marital infidelity in a motel, in a tawdry motel room somewhere.
He sounds pretty excited to me.
Oh, he sounds like a college kid. I don't think, you know, that there is absolutely zero sexiness to that track.
Thinking of you's working up my appetite, looking forward to a little afternoon delight. Rubbing sticks and stones together make the sparks ignite, and the thought of loving you is getting so exciting.
Skyrockets in flight.
How about this one?
Sadie, the cleaning lady, with trusty scrubbing brush and pail of water.
Now, before Whispering Jack, there was Johnny Farnham, and you realise he's a national treasure. So it's a very risky business.
And look, you're absolutely right. He is a national treasure. He's an amazing performer. We really wanted to call my daughter Sadie, and we went through this whole the hours. We'd spend debating whether or not we could call Sadie Sadie, because I'm thinking Sadie Frost, and it's a great name, and my wife, who's Australian, would just go, but the cleaning lady, she'll just be known as the cleaning lady. You can't call her Sadie. And that's important in Australia because you've got to run all the names by us, because Australians will ruthlessly pick your nickname and it won't be the nickname you want. And we ended up going, it's okay, it's not the John Farnham song everyone knows. And bizarrely, I've not heard that song ever be referenced to my daughter, who's now 14. So, you know, we got away with it. But yeah, it's such a powerful song for that name.
What's your Australian nickname? Have you got one? Did you get one when you turned up?
Big fella. Presto. They're the ones I can repeat.
Okay, yeah. We'll save the other ones. Presto, I was thinking.
Presto, would big fella.
Yeah, Presto's here. We're talking about the songs that he doesn't like.
There you go.
Good on you, Presto. What did you make of Australia when you first came? Why did you come here?
It was a long way away. I'd always lived in London and I thought, well, if I'm going to go somewhere, I came here on holiday in 1989. And just loved it because it was kind of, you know, I love Sydney and it's beautiful, but there was something about Melbourne. There was something about this kind of, at that point, there was nothing in the inner city. There were all these underground clubs that were super cool. The people in Australia are, you know, you make your best friends in 2 days of meeting. You know, people are really open, more so in Sydney than perhaps in Melbourne. And I just loved it. And then I came back and I came here in 89, came here in 91. Loved it both times, and then I moved back in 93 because I'd never lived anywhere outside of West London. So it seemed like a logical thing to do, and I'd reached the top of my career as far as I could go in the UK. I didn't want to kind of make the next step into kind of the kind of management-y stuff. So I came here and gave it a go, and like so many people from around the world, I've found a beautiful life and a amazing set of friends, and I've become the most annoying kind of, you know, I'm that guy who goes home and goes, yeah, I like the beach, but yeah. And it's that very un-Australian thing, a very Australian thing of totally undervaluing what we have here. When you go to, I don't know, you go to India and you go to Juhu Beach, there's 250,000 people on the beach. And it's amazing, it's great fun. And you come back and you walk down to any of the local beaches and you've got 10Ks of white sand, blue rollers, to yourself. That is just, you know, and that whole thing of, I know we were in Greece for George Kalambaris's wedding, and all the beaches were fenced off and you had to pay €60 to go on them to get a lounge. And you think, here, the best view in almost every seaside town is the caravan park. I love that. It makes Australia a very, very special place, where so many of those previously beautiful places have been significantly harmed by development.
And as long as you're at the beach and this is not on the loudspeaker, I'm guessing you'd be okay, because this is the last track on the list of songs you'd prefer not to hear again. Money too tight to mention. In fact, you said Anything by Simply Red.
Simply Red or UB40. There is something particularly creepy. I don't know. I saw UB40 live, first album, they were okay. But when it started getting that kind of that soft reggae stuff, it makes the screen cool. There's something also weird about Mick Hucknall from Simply Red. I don't know what it is, but he rings alarm bells. And I was talking to someone today who said the same thing.
He got very cranky again at the Ensign in the 80s. Mm. And Simply Red were huge and they had massive sold-out concerts here in Australia. And people went up dancing at the concert. And he literally abused us in the audience because we weren't up, and pretty much abused the audience for at least half a night.
Well, absolutely the reason there, straight away. You see there, we sense, don't we? We sense when performers aren't really into it and don't get it. And so I feel vindicated in my Simply Red judgment by your statement.
I wish that I'd had your insight before I'd paid the dough to go to the Simply Red concert, and I'm pretty sure most of the other people now, your guilty pleasures. Now, this is the one song out of the bazillion tracks that you gave us, which we've had to cull for time. This is the one song you said we must.
And it's because I only discovered it this year. I think it's one of the great songs I've ever heard. I love the sentiment. I love the guitar riff. It's a Melbourne punk pub band. It was played to one of the guys in our crew, the sound guy, Lee, who has an amazing musical pedigree. And I just love it. And it's a band called God, and the song's called My Pal. And you may not have heard it, but this should be on everybody's top 10 playlist.
It's not an instrumental, though, is it? There's words?
No, it gets really better.
Okay, more. Oh my God! There's white man's overbite happening on the other side of the desk.
I tell you, it's unbelievable. and the chorus is, "You're my only friend, but you don't even like me." It's just magnificent. There's something about it, and I think interestingly, playing alongside the Black Keys and the Sonics, and you hear that, and that's like as untrammeled, and it's the same heavy guitar sound, and it's just magnificent. And you can just see. Can you not see? Like a corner hotel or the old Annandale, you can just see a room full of heads pumping up and down, just lost in that track. I love it. It's a great record.
Now, in stark contrast to that, this is also on your list of guilty pleasures. I love that this is on your list of guilty pleasures.
But it could have been 9 to 5. I mean, Dolly Parton, Loretta Lynn, Coal Miner's Daughter could also have been on there. There's something about it. Lyrics, again, are brilliant. And again, just that, you know.
I think it's the ease of her voice, too.
Oh, it's a little tremolo on there. It's fantastic. And it's one of those songs like House of the Rising Sun that just you undervalue until you hear it again separately and you go, actually, that's not just a kind of cheesy hit. That's a really beautiful bit of writing.
He talks about you in his sleep, and there's nothing I can do to keep from crying when he calls your name, Jolene. And I can easily understand how you could easily take my man, but you don't know what he means to me, Jolene.
Now, you just named two great karaoke songs then, House of the Rising Sun, Jolene. Mm. Do you partake in karaoke? Do you have a karaoke song?
I ran with the Mean Fiddler in London, the first non-Japanese karaoke bar, a very, very fine bar. And we did the first British karaoke championships. And so, obviously, I'm a massive fan of karaoke. I have three songs. The Letter by the Box Tops, which is the shortest ever number one, so that spares you my voice.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter.
It's Mamma Mia. But my favourite now is I think probably something by Prince, actually.
Oh, which one?
Oh, Purple Rain. Because there aren't many words.
The drama of it, though.
And the drama of it lends itself to, because karaoke should be all about the drama. And truly great karaoke, as we all know, there should never be anyone in the audience. Everyone should be on stage, fighting for the microphone, singing whether they've got the microphone or not, because it is the modern chorus, the modern choir, the karaoke stage.
It's such a shame our friendship had to win. Purple rain, purple rain. Purple rain, purple rain.
Speaking of choirs, the last track on your list of guilty pleasures is this one. Now, this is a bit of a call and response hit in Australia, this track. And usually when it's played, there's a whole choir singing along with it.
Again.
you ever seen it live?
I have seen it live. And the first time I heard the song, I saw it live. And when I listened to that version by the Angels, I went, but where's the other bit? And then I went, so the audience is actually written up a response that fits so perfectly. Isn't that everything you want? That's what Australia at its soul is all about, is the idea of you're all in this together. And I think that that's fantastic. And it's the sentiment is, you know, anything that's got four-letter words in it, there's a wonderful release about that. And when we're talking, going back to why music is better than food, that song would be Exhibit A, because everyone who knows that song will have undoubtedly in their heads sung along to the audience participation part to that.
Do you?
Yeah, straight then, absolutely. Of course I was saying it.
Oh, we're going to look at your MasterChef so differently from now on.
No way, blah, 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 blah.
Matt Preston, it's been wonderful having you as our music teacher tonight.
Chris, has been so much fun.